on May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere. This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
We're back with an all-new Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
I'm Louis Fertel.
I'm Aida Osman.
And we are in the throes of Iowa caucus results.
It actually sucks. We're recording Tuesday morning, as we always do.
Just
which
a
means,
shit show.
Yeah, right in the middle of the Iowa meltdown situation. Should I just go through a list of ways I can defend Iowa as a former Iowan citizen?
It'll be a short list.
Okay, here we go. No, you're on to something. One, you ever seen the movie The World According to Garp? It's there. Bridges of Madison County, it's not in any other state.
It's not a good movie. Go ahead.
Bridges of Madison County is one of her worst nominated movies, I think. Real. And also the people who play her kids, guys, don't look them up.
Yes.
They don't need to be looked up.
Good try, Lewis. Next thing on the list.
Oh, yeah. Okay. We one time had a really great wrestling team. Football often occurs.
What's your team called?
The Hawkeyes.
Oh,
I can't really say for sure what that is. And also, you know, corn is good. I mean, I prefer it buttered.
Anyway, the Iowa caucus was Monday evening, and as people waited for results to roll in, they did not roll in. As some precinct captains reported, technical difficulties with a new app that was introduced this year for reporting vote tallies.
I know they said app. I still picture like the copy machine from 9 to 5 and someone like hitting it and papers flying out of it.
Yeah.
The Iowa Democratic Party, however, has denied any issues with their app, and they have blamed delays on inconsistencies in precinct reporting. And now candidates who are competing for 41 delegates are basically just waiting. It's Tuesday morning. There are still no results. And yet, there's a lot going on. First of all, let's get into the idea of even introducing an app in the first place.
For who?
Why?
And
for
it's
what?
A phone app? Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
Why? And some people apparently just weren't even using it. I don't know.
I don't expect technological breakthroughs to come from the state of Iowa. I will say that.
Yeah. And, like, as from my understanding of being in that horrid state, like, shoddy Wi-Fi, especially in, like, libraries and gymnasiums and cell phone service, like, there's so many things that could go wrong with using an app.
Well, I think Iowa has Wi-Fi, Aida.
I will give them that.
But I do think that introducing this just this late in the game is very silly.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to phone calls?
Right.
Exactly.
I guess what was fascinating, though, was watching the candidates have to spin their wheels and talk anyway.
Yes,
and
course.
Sort of not declare victory, but also unless be like, we did it.
Unless you're Pete Buttigieg.
Right.
But it was all in, like, the subtext of what they were saying.
Yes. You know? I mean, he mostly declared his victory and then walked it back this morning, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just saying that it was victorious that he was able to get voters in urban areas and rural areas, you know, when people thought that he couldn't before, which I think is sort of a lame answer and sort of typical of him because no one was ever insisting that he couldn't get votes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And no one was ever saying that his involvement in the race was you can't get votes. I think the critiques of his involvement in the race were that he had the privilege of being a white male candidate who was going to get votes.
But by the way, I felt like every candidate unleashed some version of, they said we couldn't do it, and yet I am here.
Yes.
It's like,
Klobuchar, we're punching above our weight.
Yeah.
I mean, let's qualify the subject here. Who's they? Let's be specific.
They, being this nebulous media, which I will also qualify as my main irritation last night. I think last night highlighted exactly why cable news is garbage.
Yeah.
There was hours of people talking about nothing. We still don't know anything this morning. And so what was the point of a 24-hour news cycle of debating results that we don't have?
And also, CNN subjected us to Rick Santorum in a sweater vest.
Yeah.
And as you know, he is not jaunty. So I did not need to see that.
There were exemplary moments of idiocy, like Wolf Blitzer being on the phone with someone who was calling to get results.
What a painful clip to have seen. That was miserable.
The phone being answered after that person was on hold for so long, waiting to answer so that they could tell Wolf Blitzer that they were going to answer this call and they were going to let it air live on TV and then getting hung up on.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Maybe worry about the fucking results instead of getting them to Wolf Blitzer.
They were calling, what, the Iowa Democrats?
Yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
They were calling a precinct captain.
Right.
Yes. And who was then like, oh, I can report these results to you live on the air.
That was, I mean, it was deeply comical. I hate using this metaphor. It comes up all the time. But, like, beyond Veep. I mean, it was just embarrassing.
That people trying to spin any sort of story out of nothing was deeply embarrassing. Also, I am just going to say that I don't like the concept of caucuses.
Oh, I mean, brave. No
it's
one's saying that right now.
It's a game we used to play in, like, preschool. You stand on this side, that's what you like. And you stand on the other side, it's just such a primitive idea. I feel like we can move towards something better.
Yeah. Maybe if I were on Wisteria Lane, you know, yeah. Maybe if I was, you know, living at Melrose Place, like, if I actually liked my neighbors.
Truly.
One, I don't want to talk to neighbors. Two, the caucus process is sort of emblematic of the people who were live tweeting the caucus last night, right? Or having caucus watch parties. We know who these kind of people are. Some of them are in our lives. They're just sort of like nerds who are very into the, quote, political process. I mean, the concept of someone who would want to go to a gymnasium at 6:30 p.m. and then argue with people and give their case for their candidate and then pick delegates and then decide who they're going to pick at the end is just lunacy to me personally. And it also seems like a thing that white people with free time get to do. if you are busy after work and you are taking care of your kids or you don't have a babysitter or maybe you're even, like, disabled and can't get to the polls or if you're deaf and can't have a conversation with people at a caucus or, you know, if you're just not white and feel uncomfortable around all these white people shouting over each other, you're probably not going to be involved in this process, which is why I prefer a primary where you can write down your opinion on a ballot and turn it in
and
mind your own business.
Yes.
How did you feel about the mountain of black voters that Pete Buttigieg had arranged behind himself during his speech last night?
I almost wasn't here because Pete called me. I said, he was like, I want 7 black women in a row. That's a bingo blackout. And I was like, Pete, I'm busy. I got a job, baby.
The thing is, no one is denying that they were his supporters, but to line every black person who was in Pete's audience directly behind him in front of the camera, it was obvious people were going to bring that up. Everything about him is an operation.
Uh-huh.
That victory speech, it sounded like...
Well, he's the new Arsenio. You understand that, right? Okay. He really was giving me spelling bee winner energy last night. Just like assuming he had the whole thing, the blazer, you know, I mean.
Putnam County is shook.
Right. How have we not nicknamed him Potsy Buttigieg? His Happy Days energy.
Oh,
okay.
Isn't he so Potsy?
Okay. Yeah. Sit on it, Potsy. The other thing is that you're waiting for what the media is going to say about it, right? And it depends on who wins if they're going to declare it as very important. I think that it is important for Pete to have won this, I guess, because he needs to inspire anyone who's not white to vote for him. And an early victory would do that. It's important if Sanders won because, you know, he's outside of the establishment. And so that would be a sign that people are turning progressive at the ballot, the caucus box. The Caucasians are ready to vote.
I did see that pun made a couple of times last
night.
Did
you?
Yes.
I thought about making it on Twitter, but it just seems like you're calling an Asian person a caucus.
Right. It's not a smooth pun.
Yeah. The pun is not viable.
There we are.
But it's very fun if you like being wonky and nerdy and following Tommy Vitor on Instagram stories.
Or as I call him, Henry Wonkler. That's right.
Otherwise, the best thing to come out of Iowa is season 2 of Scandal.
Oh, not season 4 of Girls?
No.
Okay.
That writing workshop?
Yeah.
I didn't love that season.
No, it wasn't good.
No. Defiance, Iowa, and Scandal, though. That was when they rigged the election.
Oh, of course. Right.
Yeah. Anyway, we have quite the episode this week. We will be joined by Skylar Astin.
Guys, we fell in love with Skylar
Astin. I know, it's a problem.
I have never felt this way about a straight man before.
It was really crazy for me.
Especially a straight white man.
Yeah.
If something's in the air. I really think so.
Yeah. Listen.
Zendaya, Meghan Markle, Meg, briefly.
Yeah.
Maybe it's time, Ira. Maybe it's time.
Megan Thee Stallion. Yeah. She walked back that she said, I am not fucking G-Eazy, even though y'all got jokes. She tweeted that this morning. But I think you'll talk about that later.
Yeah, we'll see.
We will also get into the Super Bowl and all of its bombast from Shakira and J-Lo herself. And then we will talk about Miss Americana, the new Taylor Swift documentary on Netflix. And look at that. Turns out the Iowa caucus results will be reported at 5 p.m. Eastern today. So by the time you listen to this, you'll already know who won.
You know more than us, and it's uncomfortable.
I'm so mad.
We'll be right back. What can I say about Shakira at the Super Bowl? Well, her hips, they don't lie.
You're trying to put her in the Knives Are Out category?
No, we need a new one. We need a new one.
I wasn't even bringing up Knives Out. Well, I have not talked about my knives for at least 2 weeks.
Okay, well, it's a preemptive keep it, so.
Is that even true, Ira? I feel like I saw something recently.
I'm keeping my knives sharpened, of course, but I'm waiting for the Oscars.
Okay, we'll see.
Yeah, where they will probably be out because Parasite will probably win Best Screenplay.
Does that make you mad?
No, it doesn't make me mad, but I do want Ryan Johnson to win.
Oh, okay. I see.
Yeah. Right. I guess that's what you're into this Oscars. We'll talk about that later.
Yeah, we'll talk about it. But anyway, the Super Bowl happened.
They insisted on scheduling a game around this event. Yes.
Yes, and Jennifer Lopez and Shakira made history on Sunday as the first two Latino women to co-headline one of the most watched events of the year. Their combined set included lots of belly dancing, hit songs, some pole dancing, a lot of Bad Bunny, and J Balvin.
Expected.
Yes, and made sure to acknowledge the political importance of the moment. But, of course, the girls were mad.
I'm sure.
The girls, of course, being press people online who were like, this performance was too hot for TV, too sexy, too racy.
Oh, yeah, that's what's offensive. Then go back to watching that game where people's brains are bashed in every second. There are movies about it now.
Yeah, that Will Smith one.
Right, yes.
Yeah.
Which was nominated for very little.
Yeah, well.
Are you guys talking about Gemini Man?
Should have been nominated for a Razzie. Gemini Man, on the other hand.
That's
a
that
movie.
Girl.
I love that movie.
Tune in at the Oscars. It'll be there.
Ang Lee did what he had to do. Anyway, J-Lo took the stage and the pole.
Right.
Which I saw as a nod to Hustlers, obviously.
Correct. She had to show off those post-Hustlers arms.
And it was shocking. It felt so quaint, to be honest, you know, and in the era where everyone was mad about Beyonce and her black militants, it felt quaint to see people call a Super Bowl performance too sexualized.
Right.
Like, it seems like we should be past the era where we're talking about women performers being too sexual on TV.
And also, by the way, it's not like they were close to naked or anything. It's just the idea of a pole that I think set people off. Meanwhile, she really was just doing sort of gymnastic-like stunts. Yeah. I actually thought it was a little bit more technically accomplished than I expected. Mm-hmm. I thought it would just be kind of run-of-the-mill J-Lo dancing.
Yeah.
In fact, when I closed my eyes and remember this performance, I saw nary a boob.
Nope.
I think at one point they turned around and you saw a little bit of their butts. Yeah, they're wearing tight-fitting clothing, but in no way was it like deliberately seductive or over the top.
I know. Meanwhile, Adam Levine last year looked like he was on the bait bus.
And again, nobody...
Niche reference for the team, for the listeners today.
No critiques about Lady Gaga's performance or Katy Perry's performance in those ways. Mm, so
sounds about white. It was obviously too... women of color on stage, two Latin women just sort of embracing their culture that seemed to upset people.
But I mean, no one said anything, of course, when Madonna performed. And as you know, she is almost Latin. She brings it up a lot.
She was a Vita. I was very into Shakira when she took the stage at first because I have always been a huge Shakira fan.
Mm-hmm.
Even when the internet was sort of declaring that J-Lo didn't need a co-headliner, which is true. I appreciated the fact that there were both of them on stage because it sort of lowered the pressure for both of them. I thought that they complemented each other very well.
Mm-hmm.
We don't generally think of J-Lo and Shakira in the same sphere, even though they're two Latina performers. They sort of operate in different sort of areas of music, right? Mm-hmm. Like J-Lo is more hip-hop and pop and sort of feels more American, and Shakira obviously is very global.
Right. I always feel like I've come late to Shakira, even though I've been a fan since she made her super American debut with Laundry Service in 2001.
Well, because we missed albums of Spanish language.
Right. Yeah. And she was a Grammy winner before that for the Unplugged she did in Spanish. But it was really awesome having people reevaluate Shakira. I think something that sticks with me is that after the Super Bowl, Shakira had, I think, 5 songs in the iTunes Top 20, including the number one, which was Whenever, Wherever, an eternal song. Love it, love it, love it.
Mm-hmm.
What was crazy to me was that J-Lo's highest charting was at number 16 with On the Floor.
Mm-hmm.
It made me think, is J-Lo's discography somewhat lacking in eternal bops?
I don't think it is. I think that the difference was that we're pretty familiar with J-Lo.
You think most people just own those singles?
You know, I think most people have those singles. Most people know the J-Lo songs that they like. I was not shocked that On the Floor was the highest charting of them all, only because I remember when On the Floor came out, it was sort of like, it felt like a comeback of sorts for J-Lo back into music, and it dominated.
You know, when I looked back and I was watching, none of J-Lo's songs gave me like a sense of nostalgia or that I wanted to go back and listen to her or stream her music, except for Waiting for Tonight because of the graphics, the way they did it. Like, it looked just like the music video.
Yes.
So I went back and listened to it. But every single Shakira track had me going, oh, baby, like, I got to go back and listen to this.
Interesting.
Mm. Yeah.
Also, you're right. J-Lo has, I guess, just patented emerald laser lights.
Yeah, that's her.
She has.
Well, remember in 2009 when everyone thought they were a cyborg?
Right.
Like the Black Eyed Peas and all of that. So that was the aesthetic very much so of then.
Right. Oh, of On the Floor, which was 2009.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. But no, you're right. That was the time of Lady Gaga, Christina Aguilera, Bionic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I will expand on Aida's point and say that people traditionally get a Super Bowl performance when they're sort of far along in their career, right? And so you do get that sense of nostalgia. And I feel like Waiting for Tonight will evoke that, but I also feel like we didn't get a lot of things to be nostalgic for in J-Lo's performance because, one, she's dominated the cultural conversation for the past year between A-Rod, between Hustlers, and this entire sort of award season. J-Lo has been front and center, for one. And, two, she's had the Vegas residency, and she's done some medleys on TV in recent history, right? I feel like other people who've gotten Super Bowl performances sort of have come out and given you something else. I mean, like, Beyonce dominates the cultural conversation, but when she came out, there was the Destiny's Child reunion, right? You know, when Katy Perry performed, I don't remember how high her songs charted, but she had Missy perform with her, and Missy's songs started charting high because there was that sense of, oh, we haven't been thinking about this constantly, you know? And I feel like Shakira benefited from being a person that we all really love, you know, like, Whenever, Wherever, Hips Don't Lie. Like, these are massive songs, but they aren't maybe songs that are constantly a part of the cultural conversation.
I was wondering also if maybe during J-Lo's performance, she didn't perform enough of each individual single. Like,
no.
I feel like none of her hooks sort of
hits.
Landed.
Yeah,
yeah right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Jenny from the Block was like 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Her performance was really geared towards the end. Let's Get Loud, mixed up with Springsteen's Born in the USA, which I thought was a beautiful moment. And I love the Puerto Rican flag.
Oh, yeah. And
yeah,
also, literally the kids in cages during that performance.
Which I mean, didn't realize until I double-backed and watched it again. The first time I was just so enthralled by Emmy that I missed it.
Right.
So, yeah, it was very powerful.
Also,
it was
a
little light as a metaphor, to be honest, but it looked pretty.
And also, that's just it. The staging was so kind of good-looking, you didn't think of it as an abrasive political moment. But I have to say, my favorite thing about the Super Bowl performance was Shakira, because she is so, as much as we know her as like a, she's an icon of sensuality in pop, she is such a genuine freak. I mean, some of these movements.
Yeah.
This woman is obsessed with moving like a, not just an animal, a weird animal.
Yeah.
Like it's like a harumphing. She cannot get through a performance without galloping. Truly, it is unhinged horse girl energy.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
She's a she-wolf.
Correct. That too. And by the way,
Loba.
Her performing she-wolf, one of the gays-only pop songs of the past 20 years. It's
no wonder why I liked it so much.
Yeah.
I didn't realize, but now I know.
Just like, there's a she-wolf in the closet, let it out. It's just so funny. It's so disturbing. And her movements during that part of the song where she's sort of individually puppeteering each of her body parts.
Mm-hmm.
So strange and one of a kind. And she's such a brilliant songwriter. She writes all that stuff.
No, I love Shakira songs. I've been a Shakira fan, obviously, since Laundry Service. And I love listening to her Spanish language albums, but I also love listening to her English language albums because the translations are always so fun.
Yeah.
I think people miss the comedy that's in Shakira songs. Like, they're so funny. Like, one of my favorite songs of hers is Poem to a Horse. Which is great. And I also love that she showed off, you know, like, belly dancing and her guitar moment. And then her on the drums and a salsa dance break. And, like, the tongue meme thing was like a Zagruda, like an Arabic celebration chant. It's like she was mixing all the parts of her Colombian and Lebanese and Arabic culture, all for America to watch. And I just love that she's this blend of so many great things. And I guess that sort of explains why she has such a huge global impact.
You know, she actually is the precursor to Lady Gaga in how she blends the brainy with the daffy. You know what I mean? There's always a reference to what she's doing. You just mentioned the Zagruda, and there was a whole bunch of cultural references in what she did that she is definitely purposely incorporating. But then also, she's legitimately so strange. You know what I mean? I think that combination is really exciting. And again, outside of Lady Gaga, very rare.
I mean, this is just overall, but I love that, you know, they're in Miami. They bring out these artists. And also they do, I like it, Cardi B's track. And I was watching Cardi B do a live stream after the show, and she was just in tears about it. So excited about, you know, getting a call out from, like, her favorite artists. It was a beautiful moment. I was really moved.
Yeah, I loved the fact that Latinx people felt represented. There was a lot of outpour from people on social media about it. I also liked the debate that it sparked, too, about the exclusion of Afro-Latino artists as well. And those are conversations that people should be having.
Yeah, which we talked about a little bit last week when I brought up Rosalía. So it is an interesting track that I feel like we're going to start going down now as well. But, you know, it's like little steps, incremental steps, but exactly to the point that you're saying.
Talking about the Super Bowl itself, it is always this interesting juxtaposition of a show making a political statement within the overall context of the NFL, which is racist and somewhat evil.
Yes, right.
So,
we're not over that yet, right?
Yeah, certainly aren't. Beyonce and Jay-Z were there. They did not stand during the national anthem, which some people said was in support of Colin Kaepernick, but I didn't. I think they just didn't want to get up. I mean, at this point, any quote unquote support of Colin Kaepernick from Jay-Z would feel sort of like
passive.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it feels
sort of like, what's the point?
Mm-hmm.
Perfunctory.
Also, I'm a little bit done like with like Beyonce cryptograms. Like, can we just like let's let her explain herself as she has to explain herself.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, this interpretation of her constantly because she gives us so little interview wise is like can get a little tiring.
I mean, we'll get into that with Miss Americana, right?
Oh, indeed,
like,
we will.
Like this whole idea of national treasuring pop stars and laying your emotions onto them is exhausting.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think that they were just there. They enjoyed the game.
Yeah.
That was that. I didn't pay much attention to the game.
Obviously.
There was a game?
Yeah, I know. My only takeaway is that the name Jimmy Garoppolo is just way too close to Janine Garofalo.
Yeah.
Like, I have to think about Romeo and Michelle's high school reunion every time this man is on the field. It's shocking, you know. Also, I thought the commercials were incredibly low impact this year.
Yeah.
No one's talking about them. Like the one with Bill Murray in it, which was groundhog related, correct?
Yeah.
That I sort of remember that. But you know what, though? I am completely fine with the conversation getting away from these damn commercials.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like, as much as like we have gotten LOLs from certain commercials over the years and that have become iconic, it's just a really gross, overtly capitalist bullshit enterprise and now outdated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I remember the era where we stopped really obsessing over them only because I feel like the commercials were released before the Super Bowl so often that we'd already seen them. And now we've got to the point where we just sort of prefer the halftime show over the commercials. And it is grossly capitalist, and nothing exemplified that more than the Bloomberg ad.
Oh, sure.
During the Super Bowl, which, I mean, we didn't talk about him during the caucus conversation, but the fact that, like, we are continuing to humor this man buying his way into an election is insanity to me. And then lavishing millions of dollars, obviously, to have a Super Bowl commercial. It's, no one else has that. And why do we want it?
And yet, I remain mortified every time another celebrity sticks his neck out for this guy. The newest one is Tim Gunn.
Yeah, for Bloomberg.
At one point in my life, I would have said Tim Gunn is maybe the only person I trust. It was 2004. Culture was going wrong.
Yeah,
it was a very Von Dutch hat era. You know what I mean? I just wanted a ballast. And it's like, wow, why? Pathetic.
Anyway, the Super Bowl is what it is.
Yeah.
I think it ranks among the best for me, though, because it was so much fun. Mm-hmm. It didn't feel sweaty at all, and there was a lot of highly technical work going on.
Yeah. I would rank it somewhere below Beyonce and Prince.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe slightly above Gaga. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the one thing I enjoyed so much about Lady Gaga was clearly the lack of lip syncing.
I mean,
I really don't care if artists lip sync. That's not something, I don't have like an integrity tied to that. Mm-hmm. But at some moments I was like, oh, Shakira, girl, you know, you don't even look like you're trying to hide the fact that you were lip syncing parts of this. It felt so pre-recorded until J-Lo came out, and then there was improvisations, and then maybe they changed it for when she did the...
You know, J-Lo was about to do some improv on the mic. She was not about to have people calling her lip syncing.
Exactly, exactly. Scream mi gente here.
She knew what she was doing with that.
And
this is a thing that we always come back to, though, right? Because, like, Super Bowl, even, like, the national anthem, it's always...
Which Demi killed.
She did kill that. It's always a thing that you have to do pre-recording for, just because there are so many elements in this live performance that could come into play that you just need to be sure.
I've always...
Whitney lip-synced her classic
national anthem. Oh, don't tell me that.
Everybody does, girl.
No,
she
performed like I said, I
over
have no...
the track, but like you have to pre-record those things.
Yeah.
Like weather conditions.
I've been completely okay with the idea of lip-syncing ever since the 1990 VMAs when Madonna did Vogue. I mean, it's the best lip-synced recording of all time when she's in the Marie Antoinette garb. So if you're ever feeling low because you saw a performer lip-sync, go back to that and realize we get good things out of it.
Also, do you just want them to stand there and not move? I'd rather see action, movement,
please,
flapper style.
Do you want them like huffing and out of breath and you can't hear the lyrics?
True.
If your performer is dancing, let them sing over a track.
Yeah, exhaustion's not cute to watch.
Adam Levine didn't lip-sync. Maybe he should have.
Fergie should have lip synced when she was doing those flips on the stage.
Whoa!
Not enough people have seen that clip still, I think.
Love
her
that
doing
clip.
Barracuda live on the Today Show at like 7 a.m. doing flips
in
leather pants, performing Barracuda from the Shrek 3 soundtrack.
She is doing intense, strange tumbling while wearing mall clothes. It is crazy.
And I want it to be my text ringtone.
When we're back, a conversation with Skylar Astin. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of blackness from NPR and how I live my life every day.
Oh, I'm glad to bear witness to it.
Each of NPR's black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of a struggle.
It sounds like you at Coachella. I'm already tuned in. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be black today, told from a unique black perspective, from Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations. There's no limit to the range of black stories, black truths.
Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcasts that center black voices. It's NPR Noir. Turn on NPR today and hear a range of voices as very nuanced and black as the country we reflect. Stories should never be about us without us.
Doesn't the black experience sound like a 3-disc Prince album we never got? Someone check the vault, please. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR wherever you get your podcasts.
We were talking about how Lewis looks like Phil Spector in Skylar's sunglasses. They're very rose-colored.
They're quite literally. I got them in Spain. And then when I was in Vancouver, it was so great. I had to, like, get... Because the actual glasses that I had were a little, like, specific, very round, almost Elton Johnny. Mm-hmm. And so it always looked like I was making some sort of a statement when really I was just trying to look at the world through rose-colored glasses. So I matched these lenses and got them, like, the everyday pair.
Oh, that's...
Well, there you go.
Poetic.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, here's a question about being a TV and movie actor. Is most of your life secretly spent in Vancouver?
I've been there for half of this year.
Yeah.
Actually, and then before that, I was in Toronto for 2 months. So I've been there for like the better part of 9 months this year. Canada in general. So I'm half Canadian now.
That's just a shocking life. People don't understand that about people who make TV
or
whatever.
Yeah, where things are filmed, definitely.
They assume you're just in LA.
Right.
Here.
Mm-hmm. And that we all have mansions. There's 77 productions going on in Vancouver right now because of the tax break and because it just like you could, it kind of looks like everywhere and nowhere all at the same time.
Do you run into people?
Sometimes. Like if you stay at like a certain hotel, like there's like a lobby bar that you're like, oh, here are all where the actors are.
Who's like the most interesting person you've seen?
Spill.
I've like hung with John Cena, which was pretty exciting.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, wow, wow.
Yeah. And Keegan-Michael Key, who's great guy.
Okay.
I know Keegan, and he was doing a movie with John Cena, so I got to basically live out my WWE dreams.
Okay.
And your sketch comedy dreams.
And my sketch comedy.
Which technically WWE might just be sketch comedy.
That's why it's for me. It's my favorite form of theater.
Speaking of theater, you are the first of the Spring Awakening cast to make it here.
Nice.
And
oh.
I'm obsessed with that whole just original cast.
You will be so delighted to know that we have a group chat.
Do you?
Really?
I was going to ask.
Do you still stay in contact?
To
fully?
This day. Like, and fully in contact.
Wow.
Like, just yesterday, I could pull it up in my recent text.
Who's most active in it?
Great question.
Because there's definitely group chats where someone is constantly texting.
Totally. Oh, yeah.
That's their main art form.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Share it. I'd say Lauren is really active. Phoebe. Like, Phoebe's always good for a good article.
Uh-huh.
Lauren's great for like occasions. She like doesn't miss one of those, you know.
Okay.
Remy is like always a double downer and a supporter. John and Leah are like always like in for the gags and the jokes. It's really like, it's honestly, it's not an annoying group chat. It's actually always lovely and delightful.
But I have,
yeah.
A Broadway Twitter to me feels like one big group thread. Just like the constant enthusiasm and cheering each other on. Is it exhausting? I'm sorry.
It feels like it can be, but really Broadway and theater in general is like one of the few places where as actors it feels like a community. And yeah. It's this really small one at that too. So yeah, so sometimes it's saccharine and it could feel that way, but like I don't know, there is something kind of warming about that. And then again, like for like Spring Awakening particularly, I feel like we all bonded a lot through that production, but also because I think it's like theater's such a grind and like it's such a different kind of a challenge that there's a level of respect that we have for one another that like makes it feel even more like a community.
Well, let me tell you, it was a grind getting tickets to that show.
I can't imagine.
I was living in New York then. I got there early in the morning. And
you did the rush?
I did the rush.
Did you sit on stage, perhaps?
No, okay. I did not sit on stage.
That would have been too much for me.
It was too much in Oklahoma, just like with the lights on.
Yes, yes.
Being at that table with the chili.
Wait, were you there the same day I was?
I was not there the day Timothy Chalamet was there, and I will never forgive myself.
I'm going to say, what a moment in my life. I won't.
Yeah. I got rush tickets. I waited in like the cold.
Yeah.
To see that show?
I'm happy you did. I mean, we had some real fandom in that show, and that was like pre-Twitter. So it wasn't like, I feel like the show would have done, it would have carried, I think, a lot further if it like came out now. Mm-hmm. I mean, I still think it's like a huge, amazing moment and like it means the world to me. But like that time in New York, it was definitely like the show.
Can I tell you something? It is crazy to me that you could have been in anything pre-Twitter because you just don't look old.
No, I appreciate that.
When you came in here, I'm like, wow, this guy is my age.
Yeah.
Do you go out for like a range of ages all the time?
I've definitely graduated from schools, I feel
you like. You have. I'm actually a little surprised by that.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of, like, anything. Yeah, I haven't been, like, any sort of student in a while. I'd say, like, Pitch Perfect was my last, like, college-y thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of, like, happy to be done with those roles in a way. Like, I like to, like, come into my own and be more leading man. You know what I mean? And I've done that a little bit on stage recently, and that's been kind of nice. Mm-hmm. People seeing me in a kind of a different lens and a different light.
You played the baker.
I did. I played the baker.
Woods. I loved Into the Woods.
Me too.
Yeah.
It's become one of my favorites in the doing of it.
Okay.
As in it wasn't before.
No, it wasn't high up. I mean, I love it, but it was like one of the more commonly known, like, mm-hmm. you know, it's like the sing-songy one, but the profound lyrics are out of control.
I feel like it's hard for, unless you're like a Sondheim nut,
right,
for Into the Woods or a show like that to be your fave.
Yes.
There's a lot of lyrics in Sondheim songs.
Yes.
So you can't just like sing them regularly at home.
No, and they're all different, and each time you do the Into the Woods, it is a totally different, like...
Yeah, every reprise is a whole other set of lyrics.
Not only are there lyrics, there's, like, different alt melodies.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of, like, Into the Woods, dun-dun-dun-dun, it's Into the Woods, dun-dun-dun, and, like, and by the way, if you think that that's difficult, in, like, Act Two, it'll be like, you have to every now and then. Like there are sour notes that are just, oh, we've added that dissonance for now.
Yeah.
But once you, like, get into it, you realize that there's a reason for every single note and, like, mm-hmm. why. And there's, like, because there's, like, they're kind of letting you know that something's going a little wrong. And that's what I love. The nuance of Sondheim is, like, that's, you can only truly, truly get into it when you get into it.
Did you have a favorite song from, sorry about that, from singing?
Yeah, I loved singing No More with my father, with my ghost father, the mysterious mm-hmm. man. And that's normally kind of a, like a skippable track for me when I used to listen to it. Mm-hmm. And it became like kind of the centerpiece for our production because we really like took it apart and like told like Sutton Foster, I got to play my wife, which was like unbelievable.
I mean, yeah, doing Broadway, It Takes Two with her.
It's insane.
Oh my God.
It's insane. I can't. And like honestly, it's her dream role.
Mm-hmm.
So getting to do her dream role with her so close up was such a thrill in and of itself. And then we like had great chemistry and it went really well. And we really like tried to deepen those two roles, the baker and the baker's wife. It's like, who are these guys? They're the only people made up for the sake of Into the Woods.
Yeah.
Little Red, everyone else has existed, you know, in the Grimm fairy tales, but the baker and the baker's wife, like, what's that fairy tale?
Mm-hmm.
So we like made them more whimsical, but also like talked about their marriage and like kids and like the strain on their business. And so we kind of like really got into it so much so that like, if you think about it, like the baker like loses his wife, he loses, he gives up on his kid. It's like a real, so No More when he finds his ghost of his father in the woods, mm-hmm. that's like the moment where the baker is like at his wit's end and he can't handle anything and no more of everything. And then like you get into the lyrics, there's like no more giants waging war. There's like a lot about like politicians. Like I don't know. It's very applicable.
Yeah.
It felt really powerful to sing that song center stage to whatever, like 15,000 people at once. Mm-hmm. And you could hear a pin drop.
Yeah. What is that like as opposed to a Broadway theater, you know, because the Hollywood Bowl is huge.
There's no acoustics, so you just have to trust that, like, what you're doing is on pitch and, like, in time. Mm-hmm. Because you sing into
That sounds horrible.
Yeah, especially with Sondheim stuff.
It's a little frightening, and, like, we don't have time to properly really tech it. I mean, mm-hmm. we had a day and a half. The whole rehearsal process is 2 weeks, and you're doing a full-scale, well, actually a bigger scale show than you would in New York.
And will you do, like, two shows, too?
There's, like, four.
Okay.
And, like, there's no acoustics.
Yeah.
You know, it, like, rolls up this hill. There's always like a delay after you hit a note or like finish a song. Like there's no applause, and then all of a sudden it rolls down.
Oh, weird!
You're like, oh, that's a strange delay.
And then people are. It's also the Hollywood Bowl, so it's like it's this big stadium for like people who don't know. And also people are just like on their phones
and
recording things.
Full on.
Those people literally recording the entire show when I saw Mamma Mia.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
You can be and basically loud there.
Yeah.
Basically loud. You could smoke weed.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
like, it's the first time. I did rent there 9 years ago, and that was a crazy thing.
It was right before I moved here, so I didn't get to see that one.
People were definitely, like, using that as, like, a pseudo-concert. Because Into the Woods, like, you kind of have to buckle down just a little bit. And, like, Rent is just like, oh, my God, I love this song. It's, like, half rock and roll. Let's, like, light up. It was pretty weird. Like smelling weed while performing.
I saw the Brooke Shields directed version of Chicago there with Ashley Simpson as Roxy, and I would describe my behavior as irresponsible. Hard not to be rowdy.
Yeah. It became interactive.
I think it was Lucy Lawless played Mama. Sure. I mean, what are you supposed to do? Not, like, yelp to God? I mean, you know, it's very exciting.
Yeah. Xena, the warrior matron.
Yes,
that's
right.
That's exciting.
Wow. Do you work for Variety? Yeah, you should be.
Yeah, right.
Should be writing these up.
I would definitely be great in, like, those, like, punny kind of reviews.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of what was, like, Brooke Shields' sitcom in the 90s?
Suddenly Seymour.
Yeah. I'll watch that sitcom.
Right.
Starring Brooke Shields.
That'd be amazing.
You have been on so many musical shows, too. Mm. And I feel like you were part of this era where now we have shows that are musicals. Like, it seemed weird back when Glee was on.
Yes.
Because, like, people had forgotten Cop Rock or whatever.
Right.
But
right.
Glee was on every week and lasted so many seasons. So long that I don't remember the last season.
It does feel like maybe it's still on. Yeah. You never know.
I discovered Billie Eilish's brother was on the last season of Glee.
Right.
Wow.
Just fully on it. And you were in, like, one episode.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, like, it's weird that you weren't in more, but then I was like, wait, you were in Pitch Perfect. Yeah. You
well,
were busy.
I was busy, and they try to always make it work. They've offered me a couple things on that show. I do not know the characters because, actually, you have to say yes to Glee. They don't tell you who you're playing until after you've accepted the role.
Oh,
so there have been a handful of times where just because of schedule, I couldn't do it. But I knew that they like had wanted me on it. Mm-hmm. And so I was kind of worried that when I did get an offer that I was able to actually do schedule-wise, that like they were going to give me some crappy role because they're like, this guy thinks he's, you know, whatever. But they actually it was like so fun. And I got to play a villain on the show, which was fun. And
yeah.
I was the lead singer of Throat Explosion, which is very...
I love the names of the groups.
Yeah, yeah.
They are always funny.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, you were the villain in that, but you only did the one.
Yes.
And then you did Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Which... There must be no other TV show working experience like that, because in retrospect, I can't compare that show to anything. Like, the sarcasm, the Sondheim-like speed of the lyrics, the agility of her performance, etc.
And that was, like, the agility of her performance, but also, like, just her on set, her working, like, attitude was unbelievable. Rachel Bloom, for those who don't know, is, like, she was the creator, star, writer, approved the outlines. Like, it's such a hard worker, but also it was just a really, like, solid hang which is so rare because we were doing a original musical in 7 days, which is like really difficult for an hour long show. I mean, that's less than like things like L.A. Law get. And those are a little bit more procedural. You're not like recording and doing dance and, you know, doing two episodes at once. Part of it is a testament to Rachel and like everyone being like, well, she's not complaining. We have nothing to complain about because she's busier than all of us combined. And also the fact that, like, we didn't even think to. We were just having fun. It was really, like, it was a real fun set. Before I signed on, I've had friends that have done it before, and they were like, you are going to love it. These are, like, your people. It's like summer camp. Mm-hmm. And, like, all I was thinking was, like, it made me uncomfortable to hear that because I was like, watch me be the guy that like doesn't have a good experience, or like, and then it would totally be on me because everyone loves it. But it was so not the case. It was like actually a blast, and we're all still, you know, very good buds.
I can't believe L.A. Law was your reference just now. I was like, we can talk about Susan Day later. All right.
I always show people the scene from L.A. Law,
the elevator shaft. Oh, the best.
David E. Kelly at his best.
That woman just disappeared.
She'd be gone.
That's how you write someone out.
Right.
Can you tell us what that process is like, too? Just, and maybe how it's different from your new show, Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist. The fact of you're learning music, you're learning choreography, you're also learning lines.
Yes.
And then you have to shoot them very quickly, which is much quicker than you would get to if you were doing a stage.
Absolutely. And sometimes the same day. So like I always call it, it's like first instinct theater. So you just like have an idea and go with it and you don't question it. That tends to like free me up on the day when we're shooting and maybe the choreography is a little bit looser. But I did enter Crazy X in season 4. So it had become as well-oiled and a fun of a machine as it could have ever been. Mm-hmm. So the only difference I would say between that and Zoe's is that we were doing original songs on Crazy X. Okay. So you're straight up learning a song.
Yeah.
But they were always clever and they got the demos to us, you know, in good time. Mm-hmm. And everything, this is actually, it's hard to actually compare Crazy X to Zoe's because they're very similar in many ways. Mm-hmm. And Pitch Perfect in the fact that like we always recorded in the production office. They just had like a little booth, and that's where we did songs that eventually went on these soundtracks and, you know, would be on the silver screen. It was like in this little teeny attic looking, you know, recording booth.
The silver screen.
Yeah. The
silver screen. I like to glamorize. LA Law. Yeah. Are you secretly 50? Yeah.
Listen, honey, does anyone still wear a hat?
Well, you may stay.
I become Elaine Stritch. All of a sudden.
This is probably just like a testament to your musicality and your singing ability. But do you tend to be on shows where you are singing and dancing and performing in those ways. Do you find yourself ever wanting to be in like very serious dramas that have nothing to do with music at all?
100%. I've actually developed things that I had a script for a while about like cryptocurrencies and it was like kind of a thriller. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm totally down. Also, I did sell a show, but it was a musical also. But this was before Zoe's and I was definitely trying to like create something for myself. And I understand that that's an arena and that's like a unique talent and ability that I have, but I do want to grow 100% and like show people that I could just act. And I've done that on stage now, which is very exciting, like not a musical and just, you know, spread my wings. And I think for a long time, I was like trying to quote unquote not become pigeonholed. Mm-hmm. And I now have hit a place where I've learned about this new thing called confidence. And I now
never heard of her.
Yeah, right. Yes. And like I still don't know her. And like I was like, no, I actually come into my own in the way that I know I will. And I'm actually just excited about it. Rather than stressing and being like, I gotta be something like sooner or else something else is gonna, I'm actually like, no, this is like a long career hopefully. And like, it will happen for
sure. Can I say, it feels impossible for someone like you to be underconfident because the skill set required to do musical TV shows or Broadway musicals, I just feel like you have to be the quickest study ever, like picking up new choreography, new songs all the time. And so just the sheer ability to do that means, oh, you have a wonderful talent.
Right.
So it almost is like, how could you be underconfident? I'm accusing you of lying.
So. Because I'm human and because I'm like incredibly insecure all the time and like want validation just like anybody else. But I have become good at like going with my instincts, trying to make it look easy. That's what like theater is. I can't tell you how many times, you know, extended
friends or whatever would come to see a show and they would just be like, it looks so much fun up there. Mm-hmm. You must be having so much fun. And you're like, I've done my job, because like we're supposed to evoke this feeling of fun and mm-hmm. like an escapism. And so like, you know, it's I'm not saying I'm a sad clown, but it's not that hard to believe
right.
that like, you know, you're supposed to just do it. And that's kind of also my job.
You see a chorus line. These people yeah, are depressed. You know what I
mean? I'm half Paul.
You see, guys,
I do think it would probably be hard to be in something where you're not singing too, because me as a audience member, like I watch Younger mm-hmm. every season and I'm constantly like, okay, Sutton, when are you going to sing?
Yeah.
Right.
Like this is what we came for. I've right. had enough.
Right.
But there's probably that push and pull from people.
I think so, yeah. And who knows? Like, maybe, like, one day I'll show people that, like, I am equally. You know, there's, like, something equally actually rewarding about a certain performance I didn't know I could do. And that actually excites me.
Yeah.
Even when I did The Baker, even though, like, there was, like, a leading man aspect mm-hmm. of that. And a lot of people in the industry were saying, like, you know, I actually, like, thought of you... Like, you'd be a great George in Sunday in the Park with George. And, like, in my head, I'm like, yeah, guys, that's my dream role. And like, you don't know that I could do that, but I think you saw a glimmer of that. And that's something I've always known. And that's, like, a great epiphany that I had. You know, because you go, like, spurts without working. And you're like, God, am I ever going to work again in this business all the time? And I think something that I've now given the same advice to other actors is that, like, I've bet on myself for this long. And I think that a lot of times there's that push and pull with confidence and fear. And I now am like, no, I know I can do this because I bet on myself. And I know that, like, I can sustain a career at this point. I know I can. It's mine to mess up, maybe. But, like, that's gotten me this far. So, you know.
Is it weird to watch as somebody who, like, okay, so your dream role is George and Sunday in the Park with George. Someone like Jake Gyllenhaal, who does not suck in any way, by the way, I'm just saying,
right.
kind of waltz in and just take it after not being a singer for forever, like yeah. as opposed to building up to it with like 100 musical roles.
100%. Well, I mean, that's tough. I have actually had conversations. There were certain male Broadway people that were upset about that because that's everyone's dream role, that mm-hmm. character. I think the fact that I've been a producer now a few times, like, helps mm-hmm. being like, guys, it's Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yeah.
He's selling tickets.
Yeah, what are you supposed to do, not
He's
cast
enormously
him?
Talented, and he sounds great.
Mm-hmm.
And some people are like, well, he doesn't sound a certain way. It's like, yes, but also something that you don't have that he does is, like, maybe a certain amount of acting chops, a certain amount of, like, wow factor, the mm-hmm. fact that he can do that, and also we know him as Jake Gyllenhaal. And I'm just like, I will wait my turn. If I don't play that role on Broadway, that's okay. Maybe I'll do it somewhere regionally and just get it out of my system once.
Mm-hmm. Let's go do it in Iowa.
I'm down. Yeah. I'm down. Iowa Community College production.
The most coveted role.
Yeah.
We can get the caucus out of the way and we'll be like, clear the stage.
Yeah. Keep some of the lighting. I've gotten better also at not comparing myself to other actors. So that is helpful. To just be like, yeah, that's his journey, and, like, he's doing it now, and, like, I'm not famous enough to do it right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And, like, that's okay. People get so emotionally involved, and, like, this is definitely it feels like a personal business at times, but it's just a business. And, like, I think that that's also a good... I'm clearly a Libra, if you guys can't tell.
Okay, so, yeah.
A complete scale.
I find maturity of this level suspicious.
I know, I'm terrified.
Don't bring up zodiac signs around Lewis.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's not my jam, shall we say.
No.
Not your jam. You're a terrorist.
It's our jam.
So, in a way. Well, in that I'm a Leo, and I believe all the other signs are inferior, God. So why do I even bother with
that? But that's
astrology?
Such a Leo thing to say.
I am also one.
My dad's a Leo.
I tell him he likes it. You'll like it.
I mean... Not yet. Coming soon, maybe.
It's a polite suggestion, you know what I mean? I take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
I'm on one of that CoStar app. Do you know this app?
Yeah, of course.
CoStar is rude.
Dude, let me tell you something. Opening night, Into the Woods, I get one of those daily affirmations from CoStar, and it goes, today might not be your best. I'm like literally about to hit the same. And that's when I was like, all right, this thing's BS.
Delete
that sounds like a killer house hiding outside
literally.
Your house.
Literally.
Astrology's stupid now.
Sometimes it gets a little fortune cookie-ish, and sometimes you're like, oh my God, totally. Thank you so much, CoStar.
CoStar will literally be like, you will be hit by a car today.
Yeah.
Enjoy.
And you're like, I guess that's in my stars.
Or just like, you're lying to yourself. And you're like, I am. Not.
We have to talk about the charm patrol of your co-stars on Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist. First of all, Jane.
Insane.
Whom I love. But also Lauren Graham.
And yes. Alex.
Yes, no, and also...
I was just with them all last night.
Holy. Oh, yeah. Exactly. And also my queen who comes up mysteriously frequently on this podcast, Mary Steenburgen.
Oh, yes. We yes. bow. We love Mary Steenburgen.
Say anything so about these favorite? People. Yes. Rank them.
Rank?
Yeah.
Impossible. They're all in a class of their own, and they're very different energies, but everyone gets along really, really well.
Yeah.
Mary is, like, as advertised, like, as lovely. Like, her and Ted are as, like, lovely a game night host as you would, like, hope.
Oof, it's I did not know they went to a game night place. That makes me real dreamy for them.
Yeah. It's kind of a Stan situation mm-hmm. with them. I like, they're all of our parents in a way.
They have game night?
They have game night.
Darcy Carden did not tell us about game night.
Strategically left
it's
that
also
out.
Like fun and like there's like a level of partying that's happening as well, like they're cool, like older folk. Lauren Graham is like the coolest person on the planet. We had weekly sushi and Soul Cycle dates, just the two of us.
She has rad English that's major so vibes to me, just like somebody who's like super smart. I think she went to Barnard.
She is 100% like a lit major type. She's mm-hmm. always right. Her writing partner is always waiting for her. Like she always has to be like, I gotta go because like my writing partner is waiting for me to write.
Oh, fuck like, yeah. That's she's, the like, energy I like.
Yes. Yeah. And she's like constantly making deals and like selling things and writing books. But she's also just like cool. And she's just got this adorable little dog and we're all obsessed with that dog. And Jane is like, I think like the hardest working person in show business right now, just because that role is incredibly demanding. Mm-hmm. And she like brings, she cares so much. And I feel like that brings like a lot of energy out of her as well, or drains a lot out of her too, because she does care, but it's, you see it in the performance.
And Alex.
Alex is amazing. I've known Alex since Glee. My God, he's enormously talented, and I think he's like he's probably going to be a fan favorite on this show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like everyone I know at NBC is like obsessed mm-hmm. with him. You know what I mean? Because like I've known him forever, so I've just like and I saw him on Broadway at Once on This Island a couple times.
Mm-hmm. So good, at Once on this
insane.
Island. Yeah,
and so I think I'm more excited about like the people that don't know Alex to like get to know him. Like that's been fun for people to just be like, what is this voice of a generation? I'm like, exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you just refreshed my anger about that Tony snub. He wasn't nominated for Once on This Island. Sorry, yeah. We're people who think about snubs regularly.
No. Yeah. More than the awards.
And he definitely got robbed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's insane that he didn't get nominated, let alone win.
Yeah. You know.
It's freakish. Yeah.
It's actually insane.
Yeah. One thing I can tell you about the Tony Awards, they're criminals.
Yeah. Yeah. Who did they rob you of?
I don't know. I should be nominated every year.
Oh, you think you should.
Just
okay,
constantly.
Yeah. Pure delusion. You ever seen Nurse Betty? It's like that.
Constantly ignored for my role in Rumors that I did on Broadway 2 years ago.
The amount of... didn't Christine Baranski win for that Once Upon a Time?
When
you get to her level, I'll tell you.
All right. Okay. Thanks for being here, Skylar.
Dude, a pleasure. I could talk about all this with you for a very long time.
Yeah.
You have a devilish grin on your face all the time, too, which makes it extra fun.
Yeah, it's like half flirty, but half just like, you guys want to hang out?
Yes.
Yeah. Don't forget to catch Skylar and Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist, airing Sundays on NBC at 9 p.m. Eastern, beginning February 16th. When we're back, we're going to get into Miss Americana.
Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
Keep It is brought to you by your favorite political media company, Crooked. Lewis, Aida, and I want to give a huge congrats to our close personal friend, Jon Favreau, on his hit podcast, The Wilderness. Who wrote this?
Ira is livid.
This is a trap. Speaking of the wilderness, I've been
trapped. I feel attacked. Are we getting paid for this ad? I am going to send Jon Favreau a personal Venmo request.
Right. It's the right thing to do.
Anyway, someone else talk about the wilderness.
The Wilderness, which we are so proud to support. On The Wilderness, John looks for a path to beat Donald Trump in 2020 by talking to voters, strategists, organizers, and candidates in the battleground states that will decide the election.
He takes us along with him to the four most competitive regions on the road to 270 electoral votes and 51 Senate seats, where he conducts focus groups with voters and fellow grassroots organizers and candidates who share their winning strategies.
Here's the thing. It actually is an amazing and informative show, and I actually do listen to it. Wow. I would never tell John that.
I've never been more ashamed of you, but go on.
Hopefully he doesn't hear this.
If you haven't heard of it yet, you can find The Wilderness wherever you listen to podcasts. Congrats on a great season, John. We love you.
That was what the copy said, and that's what he read.
I do my job.
For once, Ira, I will say this about you. You did what you had to do.
I literally did what I had to do. What the other girls literally weren't willing to do.
That sound clip will be used against you forever.
The much buzzed about Taylor Swift documentary out of Sundance finally dropped on Netflix this past weekend. And the documentary follows Taylor's life and career and pulls back the curtain, revealing all we've ever wanted to know.
Yes, because I
truly,
stay up all night.
Everything was revealed.
I stay up all night wondering, like, how does Taylor Swift feel about life?
It gave us a glimpse into her relationship. It gave us behind the scenes on the creation of the album Lover and an insight into her new candid political takes. So what did we think of Miss Americana?
It was totally watchable. Mm-hmm. And the entire thing was, like, sewn together well. I was particularly interested into the footage of her at the beginning of her career, like, before her first meeting at a record company when she's, mm-hmm. like, 15. Because she was this, like, wunderkind songwriter person initially. The movie gets into some dark stuff. She talks about having an eating disorder. She talks about that story where that guy groped her on camera, and then she had to countersue him after he sued her for, I think, defamation, and she got $1 out of him. Because that was such a weird story. It's the weird case of not just a celebrity being assaulted, but in public on a red carpet. It was just a crazy...
With clear evidence. Mm-hmm. Right. It shouldn't even be contestable.
Correct.
But... Yeah.
Right, exactly. It's, like, dehumanizing for her to have to even go through that. So there was it taught us a lot about Taylor Swift and, like, the grossness of what she's had to endure. However, I do think it's a documentary about whether or not she should have her first opinion. And I think for a pop artist in 2020, it's just not that interesting a dilemma for me. Mm-hmm. I've already brought her up 30 times this podcast, but if you watch Madonna's documentary, Truth or Dare, here's what's happening in that documentary. She's literally making fun of Kevin Costner on camera. She is staging a masturbation scene in a gigantic concert. She's an asshole. And she's doing it publicly. So, unfortunately, for my opinions on this movie, I don't think you can go back from pop stars who were just radically opinionated all the time. I feel a little bit like it shed some light on the fact that Taylor Swift has been not just unopinionated, but pretty bland for her entire career.
You know, I would actually say that I found a lot of similarities in this documentary and Truth or Dare.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. To be honest. Find Truth or Dare, yes, it has Madonna being an asshole. It has more candid moments from her, allegedly.
Right.
I still...
Oh, I mean, it's staged to death. Yeah. I don't mean to say it's not.
Of course. I mean, I still find Truth or Dare as curated as Miss Americana is, you know? Particularly the moments of Truth or Dare where, you know, it's... Here, the gay people in my life, like the family, like I'm this mother hen, you know? It's like, welcome to House Madonna, you know? That seems very contrived in the way that we are sort of contriving this Taylor Swift narrative that she is stepping into as this woman who has been very private and is now sort of letting us into her life. But I feel like we didn't really learn that much about her. The eating disorder, yes, that was revelatory. I liked the second half of the documentary a lot. The first half didn't sort of know if it wanted to be an origin story or if it was going to inform the second half. And I felt like we didn't learn enough about her pre-fame to really warrant the drop-ins that we did get.
Mm. Yeah, for me, if I had to chronicle my experience with Taylor Swift, when she first came out, I was obsessed with her, in love with her, like probably invented Swiftie. Mm-hmm. Was really in love with her. And then as she kind of went into her like electropop, Jack Antonoff phase, I fell off because I was like, this isn't really for me. But getting to see, and I have a quote that I pulled from the documentary because it was one of the first times I heard a celebrity being truly candid about their experience, like giving us a very introspective view. She says, "We're people who got into this line of work because we wanted people to like us, because we were intrinsically insecure, because we liked the sound of people clapping, because it made us forget how much we feel like we're not good enough. And I've been doing this for 15 years, and it's just, I'm tired." So my favorite part of the documentary was when she gave us those moments where I was like, it was very humanizing for her. Mm-hmm. She has been such a large figure and figurehead for young girls and for everyone for so long that I never really felt like, as much as I knew her story, as much as I knew about all of her breakups and literally every facet of what was going on in her life, I didn't know how she was truly reacting to them. So to see this between her insecurities and the scandals that were happening with her and to see the inside of it, I started to like her once again.
My problem with that quote, though, is it implies that because you are insecure or you want a certain amount of approval, then necessarily you won't have any opinions that rock the boat or whatever. When it's like, Madonna, of course, felt the same way. Or, yeah. You know, all performers feel that
way. That moment,
I felt like she said that as an explanation for why she's been underopinionated, and I don't feel like it's enough because everybody's insecure.
I feel like there are inconsistencies just in, let's get to the depiction of her relationships, right? She talks about the relationship with Joe Alwyn is making it private because of the way that she has had relationships dissected over mm-hmm. the years, right? Well, then let's talk about why you had Tom Hiddleston wearing a tank top that says, like, I heart Taylor Swift, right? There have been calculated moments in her relationship history that she has presented to the public, and I think that those go largely uninvestigated in the documentary, and it's sort of trying to trade in my privacy was invaded with these relationships, and I was made this woman who is going from man to man. You know, they play that clip where she says, I'm not taking any men home, mm-hmm. Right? But men were a part of her narrative. They were a part of her songs. Exes were a part of her lyrics.
The majority of her songs are about how she reacts to men in her
yes,
life.
And she talks about, you know, like, I thought that people just wanted me singing about, like, breakups and relationships, right? Mm-hmm. So to excise those from the documentary and at least not even ask her, what were you thinking when you were making these relationships public? Do you feel like you had to do it? Was it your way of crafting yourself in a certain way? And I just think that we didn't get an answer about that.
She pulled the exact same thing that Travis Scott did in his documentary, where one of the opening scenes is, oh, I didn't win the Grammy. Look how my career is starting to fail. And look how I'm reacting to that. I'm just going to be better. You know, so I felt like it did feel contrived. I feel like they deliberately put in things that make us sensationalize Taylor Swift beyond what we already have. Like, they just gave us the morsel so that we could start to humanize her, and then that was really truly it.
Mm-hmm.
I did like that Grammy moment. It felt like a very real moment to me. Her, you know, I'm just going to make a better album mm-hmm. because Reputation wasn't nominated.
I thought that part of the movie needed just a soundbite where she said, I know I've won Album of the Year twice, and to mm-hmm. win it a third time would be downright extraordinary, but I still feel shitty about not getting nominated.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, literally, she would be tied with Stevie Wonder, the only person to win it three times.
Well, it was kind of implied when she, like, the sheer happiness she had about winning the second time for 1989, she goes up and she's like, this is unimaginable. But yeah, you're right. Like, there definitely wasn't the flip side of that where she's like, but I'm fine, I'm chilling. Like, I have two Album of the Year awards.
Right. If I can say one thing, I feel like that's what's always missing in these Taylor Swift conversations, right? The context. Doing that a third time would have tied her with Stevie Wonder, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she always misses when talking about how the public perceives her, in that there are racial components to the way that the public perceives her, right? Like, winning for Fearless when she was 19, it was just sort of shocking to give her this young artist Album of the Year. I mean, it was sort of the Grammy sort of chasing a younger image. It's sort of the Grammys wanting to award a young white artist the same way that they've done with Billie Eilish, the same way they sort of did with Beck and Adele, ignoring, like, Beyonce or Kendrick Lamar and other parts of culture,
and
right?
And it's not like that album wasn't well-regarded. It was obviously extremely popular, but it wasn't getting A-plus reviews.
Yes.
So clearly they were into the fact that she was this young sensation.
And it ignores the fact that her privilege as a white woman in the industry has afforded her these accolades from the Grammys. And so the obsession with getting these awards and these nominations are sort of removed of the context that she exists in.
Mm-hmm. I know. I mean, seeing her like lament over her failures, and then that coupled with, I had forgotten how large of an artist she was. And
she's
is.
Huge.
She's huge. Like, was she just so ubiquitous that we're like, oh yeah, Taylor Swift?
And I also think it's possible you can be extremely popular and forget that your voice matters, mm-hmm. or whatever. So I think that part of the documentary is interesting, her figuring out whether or not she should be super vocal. And then I also think about my own feelings about her and like, do I really know what Ed Sheeran thinks about anything? And do I even demand it? Do I know mm-hmm. what Bruno Mars thinks about mm-hmm. politics in the U.S. and have we asked him about it? And I wonder if there is undue obsessive fixation and concentration on what Taylor Swift thinks. And I wonder why.
I think it was the length that she was popular. Like, you're 28 and you haven't said anything about anything regarding politics. Like, we want to know how you're feeling, especially when you operate from a generally conservative fan base.
Yes,
I think that mm-hmm. is it. I mm-hmm. think the reason that people are so obsessed with what Taylor is thinking politically is just because she comes from country music, right? And the reference to the Dixie Chicks, we're getting into the area of she didn't want to feel like she would lose her conservative fan base mm-hmm. if she came out against Trump, which is the subtext of those conversations with her dad and the people at her label, right?
Which was such a moving scene for me.
It was a moving scene, but they also keep it the subtext. They don't say, you have fans who are probably racist, who probably support Trump, who probably support Marsha Blackburn, and if you come out against them, you will alienate them. The subtext never becomes the text. It's very congenial.
Mm-hmm.
That said, it really was interesting that those guys allowed themselves to be on tape for that, because I thought it was pretty overt, them being like, don't do the thing you want to do.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's exactly what they wouldn't want on camera, right? I mean, it reminds me of like, you remember that age-old famous battle between Kelly Clarkson and Clive Davis?
Yes, and it's my like, December.
Yes, and how like horrible he was to her, apparently, according to her. And a part of me just wanted to see that battle because it seems so crazy that someone with power like Clive Davis could be so rude to a genuine superstar who obviously should do what she wants most of the time. But then I saw this conversation, I'm like, I guess it is just that blatant.
That's why I also found it congenial. You know, it was directed by Lana Wilson, who did After Tiller, the documentary on late-term abortions. And it is also produced by Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
You know, like the entire documentary sort of seems to be about her fighting the patriarchy. And if you're thinking about it in terms of sort of PR for her, right, these people work for her. So
it is flattering to her. Yeah, correct.
So why wouldn't they participate in something that makes her seem more
in control?
Powerful,
right. Yeah.
You
yeah.
know, and one thing I was really missing is that push and pull between her and her conservative fan base and her country roots, right? They mm-hmm. talk so much in the documentary about, like, her country fan base. And she talks about how, like, when you grow up in country, like, you know, like, you don't talk about your political views, this and that. There's never really the conversation about how, aside from, like, fearless to speak now, she has not largely played in country.
Right.
It,
she's
making
so
pop
long
music.
Ago now. It's
she's
so long ago.
Pop music. And I don't think people think of her as a country artist anymore. So there's no talk about how she shifted to pop, but still wants to maintain this conservative country fan base.
And I think it was also a little disingenuous to only bring up the Dixie Chicks, because obviously mm-hmm. someone like Lady Gaga has only skyrocketed after being way more political.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Most of them are, in fact. You know, Madonna, etc.
Well, it's that idea that she keeps referring to the country roots, right? You know, because like if she was talking about simply as a pop artist, if she was only a pop artist, this wouldn't matter.
Yeah.
Gaga, Beyonce, Ariana Grande, you expect pop artists to speak out. I mean, traditionally, that's what pop music does, right? Pop music, going back to Truth or Dare, which you brought up, like, it's always about challenging the system in a sense, you know?
Yeah, being provocative somehow.
Yes, yeah. Even being a woman and existing is sort of challenging to the music industry in and of itself. And there's just this sort of weird shackling to her country roots in the documentary that I don't think is really truly examined.
Mm-hmm. You know what I felt like was lacking? And maybe she was trying to approach it from, if I show you that I have relationships with gay people, or if I show you that I care about gay rights and the Equality Act, maybe that will kind of negate the conversations and the criticisms around how I use gayness and queerness to kind of elevate my own identity. I wanted her to acknowledge that. I wanted her to acknowledge that the critiques around her are that she uses it to capitalize on her own pop country, whatever agenda, but that wasn't shown at all.
Right. She talks about her connection with her gay fans, with You Need to Calm Down, but the people who were in the documentary are the Queer Eye guys, because mm-hmm. it's a Netflix joint, so of course they were going to show up. And then Todrick Hall, who... Anyway.
Moving on.
There is no relationship between her and a gay person shown throughout the documentary. Yeah. The only time we even see her with friends, to be honest, is when that girl comes over to her Silver Spoons house.
Right. Like,
that house is horrible, mm-hmm. by the way. The decor.
Wait, which house? When?
Taylor's home. The decor.
Oh, yeah, when she's sitting
it's like,
there.
Jesus.
Oh, which, well, I guess she does Todrick nails, so that's like an ally.
Like
right?
The Grey Gardens of it all.
It was interesting that when you just talked about the part where the Queer Eye guys were there, and Jonathan Van Ness at one part is like, not lecturing her, but telling her basically to be more forceful. And it was weird watching him and thinking, he really does have an influence over her. Uh-huh. I think she will do this because she's listening to him.
And then the next scene is her doing it at the awards, mm-hmm. you know? So I guess, like, there are things that are redemptive about her.
Of course.
Yeah.
I just wanted to see why.
Mm-hmm.
We
That's
see her talking to a famous queer person, and I guess that is your interpretation, Lewis. Like, she hears it from JVN, and she's like, okay, this is what I need to do. But I didn't get a sense of why she cares about gay people, mm-hmm. you know, like, and maybe she just does,
yeah,
you know, like, obviously, like, you can just be like, I support gay people, gay people should be able to have their rights, etc. But there just seemed to be no other queerness in her life.
I don't think it gets to the bottom of her political integrity. Like, we don't really mm-hmm. know when she started thinking a certain way or if she used to feel another way. Like, I think it's intentionally vague for the most part.
Yeah.
We learn about mm-hmm. her making her political statement, but we don't really learn the impetus behind it, right? They don't even talk about her photo at the ballot box in 2016. Remember, people were like, who did she go vote for?
Yeah.
Like, she doesn't mention if it's Hillary. She doesn't mention if it's Jill Stein. She doesn't mm-hmm. mention anyone by name, you know? And I think that there are just criticisms of Taylor that have existed over the years that are ignored for the easy narrative of this documentary. For instance, when there are the women criticizing her on the news, those clips, and Fox News, there aren't any clips of any Black women critiquing her, mm-hmm. which have largely mm-hmm. been the critiques that I found the most valid,
powerful, and
her
nuanced.
Career.
Yeah,
you know, critiques of her by Black women have always felt like they're coming from a real place of commenting on the way that she navigates whiteness and music, as opposed to something like showing Nikki Glaser saying that, like, oh, she's too skinny. Like, that's a superficial comment, which was dumb and body shaming. Mm-hmm. It doesn't get into actual critiques of Taylor Swift as an artist that she has dealt with in her career.
That said, the montage you're talking about when they go through a bunch of sort of mean commentaries about her, I was blown away to see Bill O'Reilly say about the Dixie Chicks they should be slapped around.
No!
Guys, why is he allowed to exist, period?
After that?
Yeah.
And that was so long ago, too. Yeah.
Sean Hannity saying, like, they're a bunch of dumb bimbos. Like, that was more shocking to me and made me want to revisit the Dixie Chicks era of when they were, quote-unquote, canceled by mm-hmm. the conservative right. Because, like, the things that were said in those news clips were far grosser than anything that was said about Taylor in the documentary.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like, there were some, like, petty, stupid things said about her, like calling her annoying and stuff. Like, nobody has ever called a male pop star annoying.
I thought they were petty and stupid. Well, Kanye.
Which is a whole other conversation. I think also, like, I will probably never have celebrity at the magnitude that Taylor Swift has, but I still felt like those moments before she was like right about to post that political thing, it felt so self-indulgent. It was so, it took so long. Like, she's on this couch freaking out, and then they toast to, like, what do they say? To the resistance. Like, you are tweeting something. Like, you are probably maybe going to lose a little bit, like, maybe some fans. But other than that, like, don't equate your strife to that of, like, what are you doing fully? You know, like, what are you actively doing? It so turned out that nearly 50,000 people signed up to vote, registered to vote in Tennessee after what she did. But what are you doing actively that's making me think, okay, Taylor, you actually care?
To be fair, they said there were voter registrations on the website. I don't think they ever qualified that they were all in Tennessee. And that was always my questioning of that narrative when it was announced, when she came out politically and they said, oh, they had that many people signing up after that. I think we talked about that on the show before. Mm-hmm. They didn't tell us specifically where those voters came from.
I also think she, I mean, that part of the movie.
Which isn't to discount it, obviously.
Right. And that part of the movie also, some person on her team, I don't think it's a relative of hers, responds with, oh, look what Perez Hilton said about you. It's like, are you really surrounded by people who read Perez Hilton quotes to you?
Yeah.
It was like, it was disappointing. In a way, it shone a light on the fact that she's been sort of apolitical the way she has been because she's surrounded by a sort of disappointingly bland, uninformed team.
Yeah.
A team that's also largely men.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and for a film that's about taking on the patriarchy, I'm still just reminded of like that 1989 win where she talks about, you know, doing this for women in music, et cetera. And yet there's just like nothing but men standing behind her on the stage, which is fine. You know, I'm a man.
Right, yeah.
but it just was weird seeing the narrative that she's putting out and then seeing how many men are involved in the creation process of her albums. Right. But then also all of the men are sort of yes men too.
Jack Antonoff doesn't object to anything she says.
I know.
Brendan Urie just seems to show up and sing whatever she tells him to sing.
Even sick. Boy, go home.
Yeah, there's no push and pull in the creation of her music. And if I can say that's one thing that I sort of liked about Homecoming with Beyoncé, right? We know that she's also a private person.
Yeah.
But sort of with Destiny's Child and the way people sort of revere Beyoncé, it seemed like everything sort of comes to her very easy. And what I loved about Homecoming was the fact that you saw her, like, starving herself. You saw her work ethic. You saw, like, how hard she was just drilling everything in. And I feel like that subtext worked for the documentary. Whereas Miss Americana, there seems to be no push and pull with creating this music. It all just seems to flow out very easily, and I don't see how it seemed different from the creation of Reputation,
that,
I guess.
I do think it was interesting watching her be a songwriter, because again, I always find the songwriting process behind pop songs to be weirdly clandestine, like we don't know anything about it. Mm-hmm. So to see her like coining phrases on the fly, it's like, all right, this is like the mechanism that makes a pop superstar.
That was fun.
That said, when she's writing that song like Only the Young and she's coming up with these lyrics that to me don't mean anything and are bland, it's like
run.
There's no pushback.
Can run.
It was so interesting. Yeah,
exactly. The no pushback with the people who were producers with her was odd. Seeing her come up with fun turns of phrases, I was like, that's why I enjoy your music. That's why I went to the Reputation tour, mm-hmm. you know? And as someone who is a black queer person who is a fan of Taylor Swift and knows how she operates in a space of whiteness and in a space that sort of straddles both of my sort of identities, and it's mm-hmm. always sort of hard reconciling that loving Taylor Swift with moments where it's sometimes difficult to. I wanted to come away from Miss Americana with some sort of deeper understanding of her and being like, oh, there it is. But I didn't really get that.
Yeah.
It was enjoyable, though.
Mm-hmm. It was cute.
Yeah, fine.
It was cute.
2.5 stars.
I mean, I think now in retrospect, too, at the time I was such a Kanye fan that I was really blind, and I wasn't really that interested in Taylor Swift, that I allowed him to do what he did, mm-hmm. you know, in my mind. But now looking back and realizing she was 17 and now having been that age and understanding how young and stupid you are and how much that really affected her psyche, I think that the documentary really swayed that for me, at least.
I will say that we've long reconciled the fact that like maybe we were on Kanye's side too mm-hmm. much because, I mean, fuck him, right? But there was a concerted effort to remove any of the retaliation she did to Kanye in the midst of all that. That was all sort of glossed over. But the thing I found glossed over the most was that thing happened to her at the VMAs, right, when Kanye interrupted her. Mm-hmm. Not once do we see the clip of Beyonce bringing her back on stage and giving her her moment.
Yeah. Right, right, right.
And that was another woman supporting her. It was a black woman supporting her. And it was Beyonce using her moment at the VMAs to give Taylor a moment, and it's not even in there. It's not even mentioned.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Anyway, when we're back, keep it. And we're back with our favorite segment of the episode. It is Keep It. Lewis, you look sullen.
Oh, yeah.
Look at you.
I'm not sullen. I'm simply weary of the fact that it's Oscars week. It's a very overwhelming time for me, spiritually, emotionally, etc. So for my Keep It's this week, and by the way, you can see me on the red carpet yet again. If you click on the Oscars hashtag on Twitter, I'll be there interviewing whoever allows themselves the chance to.
We won't be doing that.
Okay, I'm so sorry.
Lost my computer.
Sorry. Right.
So I thought I would just say Keep It to a couple of notable Oscar wins I don't like. Thought that would be fun of me.
The people want to hear Lewis talking about the Oscars.
Right. Yes. First one. 1988 Best Actress, Jodie Foster in The Accused. Guys, no movie has aged poorer. It's a tragic story of a woman who is raped, but unfortunately, there's another tragedy in the story, and that is Jodie Foster's accent. Oh, my God. It doesn't hold up. It does not hold up. Oh, yes.
You want to do it?
The heir apparent to Jodie Foster's accent. Ira. Secondly, I want to say Keep It to the Oscars for not having nominated Joaquin Phoenix for Her. I think that is one of the definitive performances of the decade. Mm. I did not expect this man on his recent tour of wins for Joker to impress the hell out of me so much with these speeches criticizing various things, but most recently the racism of the BAFTAs and how they didn't nominate a single actor of color this year. I'm not saying it's more impressive because he's white, but let's face it. One thing we are seriously lacking is just white people pointing out certain things. You know what I mean?
One thing we're lacking is white men pointing it out, to be honest. It's usually some white women and like largely women of color who have to go on stage constantly and say, hey, our industry is fucked up, right? Mm-hmm. And it was nice seeing Joaquin do it in the home of colonialism. Right.
with all the stoic white faces right? leering back.
They're like, please don't do this, Joaquin.
Oh, God.
We just lost Harry and Meghan. Like, you can't do this to us, not the BAFTAs.
Only a couple weeks ago, he had that brilliant SAG speech where he was toasting all his fellow nominees. I just did not expect to be won over by him so much this awards tour. So congrats to him.
Joaquin Phoenix. I just don't like the Joker.
Yeah, I know. Me neither.
I just think it's such an awful movie.
I will say if he wins for this movie, which he definitely will, it'll be one of the more disappointing Best Actor wins because think of how a crazy person looks in a movie. That is exactly what he does in this performance. It's not a new take on crazy. It's just not.
Yeah.
You know? It's the same argument about how like Marriage Story was easy to act in even though it doesn't like, you know how we sensationalized it so much. It's like you are doing the most. The most is not hard to do. I think doing the least in a nuanced way is what's hard to do.
Right. I'm just sad because he's going to win and Antonio Banderas will not win for Pain and Glory, which I think is the best performance of Antonio's career, and I recently went to watch it again for a Collider For Your Consideration event where Antonio talked after it, and just hearing him talk about his relationship with Almodovar, hearing him talk about his career as an actor, it just would be such a beautiful moment for him to win. And like, I just think Pain and Glory hasn't been talked enough in the conversation too, you know, like those scenes with his mother at the end of it. Antonio talked about how those are things that Almodovar had wanted to say to his mother for years and sort of never had, even though he'd made a film like All About My Mother. Mm-hmm. Like he never really expressed the fact that like he's sorry that he's not the son that she wanted.
Right.
Like he didn't turn out how she had wanted him to turn out. And Antonio said that in years of knowing Pedro, he's never seemed happier. Mm-hmm. And it's like this movie seemed like such therapy for both of them and seems to have meant so much to their careers and the gift they've given cinema that I think it would be beautiful to see Antonio rewarded for Pain and Glory, but...
We are deeply familiar with Almodovar. There are so many people who have yet to discover a single film of his. Guys, it's super rewarding. Go back. I mean, like, there are some wild capers in there, mm-hmm. deeply sensual movies, etc.
And it's nice seeing Parasite nominated, too. You know, I'm like, right. I would love for Almodovar to have, like, a moment like that where it's lauded, like, Best Picture and Best International Feature, but I think we're sort of past that era for Almodovar, right? You know, mm-hmm. he's sort of... old guard in film at this point.
And he's Oscar winner, obviously. And finally, the Oscar one I want to say keep it to, an eternal bad decision is Sandra Bullock winning for The Blind Side. I think about this win every once in a while.
Not only, truly awful performance.
Not only did she win, she beat one of Meryl Streep's top 10 performances ever in Julie and Julia. Mm-hmm. For a biopic performance, I think that might be my favorite biopic performance of all time. Because it's a combination of accurate, wild, hilarious, and believable, while definitely being a take on the character. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just a sort of by rote, I can do all the ticks exactly right sort of performance. I think mm-hmm. it really is delightful.
I think The Rat in Ratatouille is my favorite biopic performance.
Oh, sure.
But I really did love Meryl in that. I don't think Sandra's performance is awful. I just think that the entire concept of the film The Blind Side is odious to me.
Right. Mm-hmm. No, again, it's the true story that does not need to be made into a movie.
Yeah.
The point we're getting from this movie is like, isn't it nice of her that she did this for this guy? It's like, why are we celebrating that? She was a rich person? I don't know.
You don't want these black people on the field? Let me tell you something. Is she Southern in that movie?
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Yes, that's right. Leanne Toohey. Yes.
The most successful thing she does in that movie is like dye her hair blonde.
Right.
You know, believably.
Where was her win for Miss Congeniality?
That's what I'm saying. And then, of course, we nominated her for Gravity when she was fabulous in, and then we don't give her the win. That's how it works.
Okay. Well, my keep it today goes to, as I'm sure you guys all saw, the uproar around the Meg Thee Stallion and G-Eazy debacle, which luckily Meg cleared up this morning. Thank you. Thank you, because we were all clearly so stressed. But and this is going to be way more nuanced than I can fit into one keep it, but it reminds me of the conversations that we have about black women and interracial dating and how they are extremely villainized and demonized for doing that just right off top. But, you know, most of it was jokes that I saw on Twitter, on the Bird app. However, a lot of it was serious. A lot of it was, you know, fuck Meg Thee Stallion. How could she do this? She's a traitor. I even at the beginning was like, oh, Meg the traitor. But I would like to say there is a shift in consciousness happening. I think we are realizing how to seize power is to date the enemy. And I want to point to...
Oh, this is an act of subversion.
Yeah, this is true. This is true. I want to point to Zendaya, who was seen gallivanting out of Strand Bookstore yesterday with her co-star, Jacob Elordi, who plays Nate on Euphoria. They seem to be dating. They're very coupled up. They look cozy.
Allegedly.
Allegedly, I know, but they're very close. They're a little close for comfort. I want to believe they're dating. I want to believe something's going on. Okay, so that's one. Two, Meghan Markle and her white king, Harry. They've been causing uproar. Again, once again. So we have those two. Who else do we have?
Are they the star of a streaming series yet?
They'll have their own Michelle Barak production company soon. Just wait. And we'll never get to see it. Just like this. Thirdly.
London Side with you.
Thirdly, there is London Side.
South York with you.
Thirdly, there is. I was out the other night and it was February 2nd, which is about when this was all happening. And I was at a work party for Big Mouth. And while we were there, I felt this pull to this beautiful white boy that was sitting in the corner. And let me not forget to mention, Skylar Astin was in here doing the interview, and I fell in love with that man. So I know that, again, there's something happening.
A climate change-like thing is occurring
at you. Is there really a climate change, or are you making excuses for, you know, being tantalized by the white meat at the moment?
I
think you moved to L.A. and just lost your damn mind.
No,
listen,
no.
I am not one to come for that era. You know, listen, I love a white boy here and there.
Are you didn't have a phase?
But I mean, I'm probably still in it. But, I just don't date in general. But also, ain't nobody risking it all for a white man.
I know. It's a lot. It's a lot. I'm just saying that right now, maybe it's February. I picked, the wrong month.
It is Black History Month, girl.
I know. But it's also.
You jumped out the fucking window.
It's also the shortest month. So maybe let me just get this out. Let me just get this little thing out. I will secure as much white meat as I can. And then I'll be out. But this month, I'm dating white boys. every time I date a white man or a white person, it is the most emotionally taxing thing I've ever done as a black woman. So we'll see. But I just want y'all to know that is in the stars for me. That's
well,
it.
Okay. I'm glad you're going to go find yourself a Gerald Easy.
You got to keep us posted on this journey.
I will.
Or please don't.
I will. The DMs are coming. The DMs are coming.
My keep it is to a white man.
Oh.
It is Jeff Bezos.
Oh, I've heard of him.
This photo he posted at the Super Bowl with, I just took a DNA test. Turns out I'm 100% Lizzo's biggest fan.
Pay your taxes.
Of them. One, I am so tired of people using that fucking line whenever they take a photo with Lizzo or reference Lizzo. You're not taking a DNA test.
And also, who actually wrote that joke? Because it sounds like who's ever doing Brad Pitt's award show patter at the moment.
That's also my keep it. I'm trying to. I love Brad Pitt. Right. I love him so much. Him just going around continuing to make these jokes about his divorce. I'm like, oh, we get it.
Yeah, right.
Enough. Close the writer's room.
The hokum is over. Stop it.
But maybe it's because Joaquin is giving these emotional speeches. Brad
He's
is like, I have to be the funny one.
Right.
That's why you guys like me. You missed me when I was funny.
But by the way, this picture of Jeff Bezos, I noticed that he is every age. He kind of looks 7 and also 700.
He is every version of Lex Luthor that's been on screen.
Right.
He somehow looks like Jesse Eisenberg and Gene Hackman at the same time. How? And Lizzo looks kidnapped. I mean, how do you say no to the owner of Amazon?
Right. Yeah,
yeah. Definitely. He literally looks like one shade of color. Like, you took the Microsoft Paint tool and, like, just dumped one color. His lips are the same as his forehead, is the same as his cheekbones.
Yeah, like, you go up to Lizzo and you're like, I want a selfie. Like, of course you have to say yes in this age of oligarchs.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it's a picture, so you can't blink twice if you're in trouble.
Yeah. And then, of course, my queen Omarosa resurfaced.
No, she didn't.
She responded to the photo saying, love at Lizzo.
Now, when you say resurfaced, do you mean actually walked out of the sea? Because I can picture it.
Yes. She's finished fucking that fish.
Omarosa's in the shape of water in your universe, okay?
I just imagine Omarosa in every Best Picture winner.
Oh, yeah, please.
Yeah. Like, I like to think of her in Green Book.
The King's Speech being like, the speech is annoying.
Anyway, that's my keep it, I guess. Oh, one more keep it. One more keep it to John Lovett.
Oh, what did he do?
Oh, no.
Well, he's making his gay news, like, his catchphrase, which is not my keep it. I mean, like, I'm glad that he's discovering homosexuality in the year 2020. But he tweeted something about how during the Iowa caucus drama, the winner takes it all. The ABBA song came on and no one else sang along with him, which, of course, I mean, you think Jon Favreau knows any ABBA songs? Or Tommy.
Do you also expect people just to drop what they were doing and sing a song that they were hearing?
Yeah. Anyway, he made sure, however, to tweet out a photo of the ABBA Gold album cover to let people know that he was listening to actual ABBA and not Mamma Mia. And
You felt that was homophobic.
I felt that was homophobic. Yeah. The homophobia jumped out.
Gay news. You're a hater.
Yeah. Pete news. I'm gay. We teach men to make themselves gay, but not too much. Otherwise, you will offend the straights. And then I said, wow, you need to let people know that it wasn't the Mamma Mia version, right? And he wrote, haven't heard that version. Either he's telling the truth, and I'm disgusted, or he's being sardonic, and I'm disgusted.
See? Solved.
Anyway, that's our show. Thank you to Skylar Astin for joining us.
Homophobia is the name of the game.
If it wasn't for the homophobia nights.
I love that song.
Thank you, Skylar Astin, for joining us. And we will see you next week with our Oscar bonanza. Lewis can hardly contain himself. Keep It is a product of Crooked Media. Caroline Rustin is our producer. It's Caroline, like the princess, the one you don't care about. Our editor is Bill Lance, and Kyle Seguin is our sound engineer. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn and Nadine Melkonian, for filming and editing our video content every week.
Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.